On the 20th of March 2016, a special service was held at Anglesey Brook Methodist Chapel and Museum near Crewe. The service marked the centenary of the legalisation of conscientious objection. Attending the service were relatives of those original conscientious objectors and some more recent objectors too, and we'll speak to them later in the podcast. The service was led by the Reverend Inderjit Bogle, former president of the Methodist Conference and president of the Methodist Peace Fellowship. The preacher was Dr. Jill Barber, vice president of the Methodist Conference and director of Anglesey Brook Museum. After the service, I spoke to Jill and I asked her what she'd found most interesting about the day.
I think it's been amazing. I think one of the most exciting things for me is meeting people that have come along because they have got a link. Either they were conscientious objectors themselves or someone in their family was. And they've just picked it up on the radio and heard about it and come along. And that's been really exciting.
What I love is how proud people are, really, the fact that they're there. Their relatives were some of the few people that stood up and said, no, we don't approve of this.
Amazingly. And it's something that families, it's been a bit of a shameful secret in the past because they face such ostracism, really, even from people in churches. And so for the families, this has been really releasing that they've been actually able to publicly celebrate ancestors that they are actually proud of, members of their family, and that in the past, you know, it hasn't been so easy for them. So it's been wonderful being part of people's journeys.
We're here at Anglesey Brook. I take it this location was chosen because of the link with primitive Methodism and the link with that and conscientious objection.
I think so, partly because we did an exhibition here to commemorate the First World War, and we very much wanted to focus on the stories of the conscientious objectors because we felt they'd been rather overlooked. And primitive Methodism is an interesting one in that it was largely a pacifist church right up to the outbreak of war. Arthur Guthrie, who went on to become president in 1916, he was saying amazing things against the war, saying it was the policy of hell and the statecraft of Bedlam and all the rest of it, really strong at peace meetings. And then the minute that Lloyd George took us into the war, he switched. And it's very perplexing, really, to understand how they then felt that the duty of the church was to be loyal to the state. The Wesleyan church was already more pro-war because they already had a history of Methodists serving in the armed forces. Interesting, a lot of Wesleyan Methodists actually became Christians through being soldiers, and it was through the army chaplains that often they became converted. So slightly different story there.
In the modern context, is there still space for conscientious objection?
The choices we have to make today are there. I mean, let's face it, we are at war. We're a country at war. It's different every generation. The nature of war changes. And actually, we all have a responsibility to think through what we feel our discipleship as followers of Jesus. What are the decisions we can make as individuals, but also what we should be campaigning about politically. After all, our government recently voted to bomb Syria. Now, all of us have the choice to write letters to our MP, whatever we feel is the right course of action. We all have, in a democratic country, that decision is down to all of us.
Alan Doane from Chesterfield is the son of William Ralph Doane, one of those first Methodist conscientious objectors.
My father was a consci during the First World War. He was not prepared to submit to being ordered to go and kill his fellow man. His attitude was that you loved your fellow man. That was how he interpreted it. And working for the good of the community, he was very much one given to helping somebody who was in difficulties and that sort, and always a willing helper.
So he was a man of peace.
Yes,
really, and you had a very strong religious conviction as well, didn't you?
Yes, he was he was a church adherent of the type where he went the extra mile, doing if there was a Sunday when the preacher didn't turn up, he'd make sure that there was a service.
And how did his friends and family react to him being a conscientious objector?
His close family were quite strong supporters, but there were one or two people on the fringe of the family who had this one that, you know, our Joe's gone, why can't he go?
So when the war was happening, what was it your father did then while he was a conscientious objector? What did they make him do?
Well, there was a short spell in Worman Scrubs when it was the standard procedure was a mailbag sewing, four stitches to the inch. and then they sent them to Dartmoor. They were using it more as a holding pen rather than... There weren't restrictions on the coming and going. There was a degree of freedom of movement, but they had roll calls and that. He finished. He was transferred after one or two false starts onto the stable party, and he was given a team of horses and sent out ploughing the moors.
And I understand that some of his possessions are here at the museum at Anglesey Brook.
Yes.
But what's on display here?
It's his discharge papers from military service, and it says on it, you know, conduct while in the colours, and it says bad.
You must be very proud of your father's stance.
He was very strong-willed. He's very strong-willed. If he made a decision, he went through with it.
Do you think your father's stance has had any impact on you?
I didn't do national service. I remained in agriculture or in education until I was 26, well, 27. And then I went into teaching after that. My younger brother, he registered as a conscientious objector. And that was in... He was 3 years younger than me. But he should have done national service in the early 1950s. And he registered as a conscientious objector. It's one of these things where it was in the blood.
David Graham from Manchester was a conscientious objector in the 1950s when he refused to take part in national service.
So I became a conscientious objector because I believed in non-violence. I'd been very active when I left agriculture to work with the Peace Pledge Union, to work with the Pacifist Youth Action Group, Operation Gandhi, and various actions we took outside the Home Office. So I became a conscientious objector because, particularly in peacetime, I felt the state could not enforce me to be posted and to fight in the colonies that we still had.
And what did you find was the reaction of your friends when they realised that you were a conscientious objector?
That's a very good question, because my friends and family were very political, very much on the left, and I think they were very split. They were against colonialism and imperialism, but by and large, conscientious objection was not really considered, was not part of the culture. But nevertheless, I got enormous support from my family and from my friends, and of course from the various groups that were involved with non-violence.
When you've completed the paperwork to tell the government you were going to apply as a conscientious objector, what sort of reaction did you get back from them? What was the process you went through? Because I imagine it was probably quite rare for them to come across somebody who said, no, I'm not going to be conscripted.
Well, it's quite interesting, because I was sentenced to a year in prison. And this comes as a great shock, that people didn't know that conscientious were still being imprisoned 10 years after the war had ended. And I went to prison together with, I think, 8 or 9 Jehovah's Witnesses who were also what were called absolutists. There were 3 or 4 Quakers who accepted alternative service, that is, working in mines, working in the hospital. There's nothing wrong with that. But we, those of us who were pacifists, and I use that word very carefully because I'm not sure that I'm would be strong enough to be a pacifist in all circumstances, because one of the questions the tribunal, which are 3 worthies from the local community, a minister of religion, I think a trade unionist, shame on him, and someone else, said to me, would I have refused conscription during the Second World War? I think I gave them good cause to reject my claim to conscientious objection, because I said I didn't know, and I didn't know because our family are Jewish, that after the war we found out that our families who didn't escape the Nazis were all murdered. I genuinely could not say I would not have resisted conscription during the Second World War, even though I would have been very active in opposing the preparations for war. I don't find it an easy question to answer, but I do believe in nonviolence. I don't know whether I'm strong enough to be a pacifist.
Do you think there's anything that conscientious objection can tell us today about how people can make a stand against governments going to war on our behalf?
Yes, and I think there's some, with social media in particular, I think that one has to take that into consideration with movements like Occupy, with the enormous demonstrations that have been in America and elsewhere through social media. I was initially, as a sort of old-fashioned sociologist, a bit dubious about that. I felt that everything had to be done by face-to-face personal meetings. And I think that what we can do individually is to try to live a life that is nonviolent, to join with other people, whoever they are and wherever they are, to try and form a common front and to campaign and agitate that the money that is spent currently on war and currently on arms is used for alternative purposes. And there is a big movement afoot to try and get that legislated as far off as that may possibly be.
You can find out more information about Methodism and the story of conscientious objection on the Methodist Heritage website. There are resources on the topic, and you can find those on the Singing the Faith Plus website. You can also look on the internet for information about Anglesey Brook Museum.